This is Jeff Blankford with the July 12th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Even before the revelations of Donald Trump Jr.'s exchange of emails with Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya, it has been open season on the Kremlin among both members of Congress and the U.S. media that is as intensive as I recollect it as almost at any time during the Cold War. But now it is the Democrats and self-proclaimed liberals who are leading the charge, with three failed Republican presidential candidates, Senators Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and Marco Rubio, providing them with a verbal equivalent of hellfire missiles. They were not needed by MSNBC's Rachel Maddow on the night of President Trump's two-hour visit with Russia's Vladimir Putin. She was ready with a vicious diatribe targeting Russia's president and a prepared special segment hosted by former NBC correspondent Richard Engel that attempted to portray Putin in the words of former Russian chess champion Garry Kasparov, who Engel interviewed, as the greatest threat to life on the planet. Berkeley Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who had been a lone vote in the House opposing the Iraq War, tweeted, "Outraged by President Trump's two-hour meeting with Putin, the man who orchestrated attacks on our democracy, where do his loyalties lie?" End quote. Well, aside from the fact that no evidence for such orchestration by Putin has been presented to the public, nor for that matter for the health of our democracy, pre-Trump, would she actually prefer fighting to talking? And here is Charles Blow, in Monday's New York Times, seeming to question Trump's meeting with Putin, quote, "the man whose thumb," he wrote, "was all over the scale that delivered Trump's victory," end quote. It was like a father meeting his offspring. Well, it was left to Bill O'Reilly's replacement at Fox News, Tucker Carlson, to interview Professor Stephen Cohen, a thoughtful, sober expert on Russian affairs, to provide a rare dissenting view. Dissenting views, as you have learned by now, are what you will generally hear on Takes on the World, and today is no exception. At approximately 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking once again with investigative journalist Gareth Porter, getting his take on Trump's meeting with Putin and the media's response to it, as well as discussing his recent article for Consortium News, foisting blame for cyber hacking on the Russians. So stay tuned for that. Admittedly, Trump should have anticipated that his meeting with Putin, whatever its length, would be a lose-lose situation for him. He didn't make it any better when, given the ongoing investigations on Capitol Hill, he suggested the two countries partner in a cybersecurity effort. "I'm sure that Vladimir Putin would be of enormous assistance in that effort since he's doing the hacking," quipped Senator John McCain on CBS's Face the Nation, where he is a reliable fixture. Senator Graham, whose anti-Russian attitude is equaled only by McCain, had told NBC's Meet the Press that working with Russia on cybersecurity was, quote, "not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close," saying that Trump's apparent willingness to, quote, "forgive and forget," stiffened his resolve to pass legislation imposing additional sanctions on Russia. You may recall, in one of my past programs, I played the audio from a video of Graham and McCain meeting with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko and a group of Ukrainian soldiers, urging them but to carry the war to the Russians. Well, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Southern California Adam Schiff, a frequent guest on NPR, told CNN's State of the Union program that Russia could not be a credible partner in the kind of cybersecurity unit that Trump suggested. "It's our best election defense. If that's our best election defense, we might as well just mail our ballot boxes to Moscow," end quote. Well, that helped to distract the media from focusing on the ceasefire agreement Trump negotiated with Putin over Southwest Syria that seems to be holding, as it didn't rate even a mention in a single word in today's New York Times. Well, each day seems to bring a new and bewildering chapter in the Russiagate story, the latest being a meeting with Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, the country's first son-in-law, and former Trump campaign director Paul Manafort, with a Russian lawyer, Veselnitskaya, who claimed to have information that would damage Hillary Clinton's election chances. Yesterday, the younger Donald released all the emails leading up to the meeting that seemed to contradict the way that Trump Sr. and his overworked spin doctors had described it. The press and the politicians' reaction to that story when it broke caught the attention of Consortium News' Robert Perry, also a frequent guest on this program. Parry pointed out that the different reaction by all parties to the latest frenzy over a meeting between Trump Jr. and the Russian lawyer, who was dangling the possibility of information about the Democrats receiving money from Russians, and the report during the campaign that Clinton supporters had paid large sums of money to, quote, have ex-British spy Christopher Steele use his Russian connections to dig up dirt on Trump inside Russia, resulting in a salacious dossier that Clinton backers eagerly hawked to the news media, end quote. The different reactions to the two reports, writes Perry, represents one of the more remarkable moments of the entire Russiagate hysteria, end quote. Also, he notes, the two events, Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer and the Clinton camp's commissioning of Steele's Russia dossier, both occurred in June 2016, so you might have thought it would be a journalistic imperative to incorporate a reference or two to the dossier. And that's Robert Perry. Well, most, if not all of us, including Trump's victory, can be traced back to the U.S. orchestrated coup in Ukraine in 2014, the evidence of which was contained in two audio clips that I played twice for you on Takes on the World. The first was a clip of a videoed speech by Victoria Nuland, Clinton's former press spokeswoman, who, after Clinton resigned, was appointed by Obama to serve as Deputy Secretary of State for Europe and Asia. Listeners heard her telling a group of Ukrainian Americans that Washington had spent $5 billion, that's billion with a B, trying to create regime change in their homeland. The second was an audio of a phone call between Nuland and Jeff Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, before the coup, discussing who should be appointed prime minister in a new Ukrainian government. Nuland, obviously calling the shots in the conversation, tells Pyatt that it should be Yats, the nickname they had adopted for Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and not Klitsch, the nickname they had given former heavyweight boxing champ Vladimir Klitschko, who was also involved in the Maidan Square protest. As it turned out, Yats got the job. What's important to know, as I mentioned before, is that Nuland is the wife of Robert Kagan, co-founder with Bill Kristol of PNAC, a group of pro-Israel, anti-Russian neocons that called itself the Project for New American Century. It came together during Bill Clinton's presidency, largely ignored by the mainstream media and undetected by the left, despite the presence of major Washington figures such as Elliot Abrams, Dick Cheney, Francis Fukuyama, Steve Forbes, and Norman Podoritz as signatories. It called for Washington to eliminate any threat to its global domination, and first on its agenda was the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. To accomplish that, a number of PNACers managed to get appointed to the Bush administration's inner circle, including Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. Both claimed credit for orchestrating the war in Iraq, with Doug Feith being allowed to set up an Office of Special Plans designed to produce the fake news about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to justify it. Though elected as an anti-war candidate in January 2009, even before he was sworn in office, with the support of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, President-elect Obama effectively pardoned and protected those responsible for the war, telling the American public, quote, we need to look forward, not backward, end quote. Mesmerized by the presence of the first African-American in the White House, what anti-war movement that existed rolled over on its back and never made an effort to regain its footing. It continued that way for 8 years despite Obama's expansion of the drone wars, his assassination program, his support of the Saudi war in Yemen, the insertion of U.S. troops in Syria, and his expanding of the U.S. military footprint across the African continent. When the situation in Iraq under Bush began to unravel, PNAC dissolved without any fanfare, later to reappear as a foreign policy initiative with the same Robert Kagan and Bill Kristol as co-founders. The FBI and a sister organization, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, like PNAC, has managed to evade the scrutiny of the left for reasons I will let you speculate, but you will occasionally hear its director, Mark Dubowitz, being interviewed on NPR regarding Iran, where his views are predictably hawkish. That the neocons had been thwarted by the election of Obama was a pleasant myth pushed by some liberal commentators who had never mentioned them in the first place, and thus ignored their presence in the Clinton State Department. Before being hired by Clinton as her press spokeswoman, Victoria Nuland was a high-level advisor to Dick Cheney, a fact that apparently was not mentioned by the press in keeping with its silence about her marriage to Kagan. Hubby Robert was not idle. During the 2004 election, he served as John McCain's foreign policy advisor. And what did you know? After her appointment as Secretary of State, who should she pick as her foreign policy advisor but Kagan? Thus, it should come as no surprise that Kagan was among the first to endorse her candidacy last spring, writing that while she would not admit it publicly, her foreign policy was that of the neocons. Recall that during the campaign, Clinton was quick to say that she would stand up to Putin. She called for a no-fly zone over Syria without qualifications, which drew a warning about the possible consequences of a clash with Russia from General Dumford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. If she had been elected, we would have likely seen that implemented. She had repeatedly called for it over Obama's objections, as she had successfully pushed for overthrowing Gaddafi in Libya, despite the president's reluctance to get involved there. Clinton was also a strong supporter of NATO and is moving her troops toward Russia's borders, which violated an agreement made by the first George Bush administration with Mikhail Gorbachev. This was then legitimized by Washington and its allies when Putin responded to the coup in Kiev, stage managed by Nuland, by annexing Crimea and supporting resistance to the coup plotters by the Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine. That move was no doubt anticipated by Washington, since Crimea had historically provided Russia with its only warm water outlet, and which for that reason the Russians still maintained a naval base with 25,000 troops in Sevastopol long after Nikita Khrushchev had signed Crimea over to Ukraine. None of this background seems to be of sufficient importance to the mainstream media that they choose to inform their readers about it. In fact, we are told, all the problems began with Russia's seizure of Crimea, which we are rarely told but had been part of Russia for most of its modern existence. The coup that forced out Ukraine's elected president, Viktor Yanukovych, is rarely ever mentioned 3 years after it happened, nor is the fact that it occurred immediately after he had made agreement with the EU to hold an election after which he would peacefully step down. The most right-wing of the protesters in Maidan stepped up their attacks on Yanukovych and forced him to flee for his life. Apparently a peaceful transit in their nor Washington's interests. Ditto, apparently, for the New York Times' David Sanger, who in Monday's paper described a meeting between Secretary of State Rex Tillerson with Ukraine's President Poroshenko, who Sanger tells his readers, quote, took office after one of Mr. Putin's acolytes was pushed from power, end quote. One of Putin's acolytes is how Sanger describes an elected president of a European country who is chased from office by a U.S.-orchestrated coup as if his name is of no consequences. While Yanukovych was supported by Putin, only an ignorant U.S. journalist would portray him as an acolyte. Back in 2004, according to a BBC profile, Yanukovych had openly been supported by Putin, but relations became strained, not least because of a dispute about the cost of Russian gas. Yanukovych tried hard to shed the image of being a Moscow man, and when he became president, he pointedly made his first foreign trip as president to Brussels rather than Moscow. During his presidency, according to the BBC, Yanukovych steered Ukraine toward a closer relationship with the EU. But then in November 2013, days before it was due to be signed, he rejected an association agreement with the EU. With Ukraine's finances in a precarious state, he argued that free trade ties with the EU would jeopardize Ukraine's existing trade with Russia, an argument that was supported by Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine, but rejected by the more European-oriented west of the country. Yanukovych said he could only sign an agreement with EU if it provided the country with substantial financial compensation. The EU refused, and the rest is history. However, it's only logical that Putin would have done whatever was in his power to defeat Hillary Clinton. Despite the fact that Russia had not attacked the United States or ever threatened to do so, she was portraying him as an implacable enemy of the American people and our way of life. But there was not a single shred of evidence presented to the public that he tried to push the elections in Trump's favor. The fact that the statements repeated over and over and over by the mainstream media, the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies concluded that Russia was behind the hacking of the Democratic National Committees and John Podesta's emails, doesn't make it any more true today than when the lie was first told. As I reported last month, citing an article by former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, the Director of Intelligence, James Clapper, had acknowledged that only three agencies were involved, and those representing the agencies had been handpicked, and this was confirmed later by former CIA Director John Brennan. If this is not a secret, why does the media continue to perpetuate a lie? Finally, let's look at another subject which didn't get much attention. Last week, the Netherlands launched a complaint with the Israeli government after dozens of Dutch solar panels donated to West Bank villages, a village was confiscated by Israeli authorities. The hybrid diesel and solar power electricity system was installed last year in a remote Jabhat al-Dib, a village home to 150 people in an area of the West Bank occupied by Israel. The panels were not built with proper permits and permissions, the Israeli authorities said, confiscating equipment belonging to 307,000 euros, which is what the humanitarian project cost last week. Critics point out that building permissions for new Palestinian homes and infrastructure are almost impossible to obtain. The village mayor told Palestinian outlet Ma'an News that the panels were destroyed, although Comet ME, the aid organization which installed the panels, said between 60 and 90 were taken away intact and other equipment at the site destroyed and left behind by Israeli forces. The Dutch Foreign Ministry has asked for the equipment to be returned to Jabhat al-Dib and is considering what next steps can be taken, according to Haaretz. The Israeli military agency responsible for coordinating policy in Palestinian areas said that work stop orders were issued before the day of the raid. Villagers maintained they didn't know the site had been targeted until Israeli soldiers showed up to take away the panels. Jabhat al-Dib is very close to Israeli outpost villages, settlements illegal under both Israeli and international law, which enjoy a full connection to the main power grid. Haaretz said that before the solar panel system was installed, the 150 residents relied on a couple of old and noisy diesel generators for 3 hours of power a day. More than 300 structures in the occupied West Bank, demolished by the Israeli authorities in 2016, were at least in part funded by the EU or international NGOs. Last year also saw the highest number of Israeli demolitions of Palestinian structures since rights groups began keeping records. As I have pointed out before, sadism against the country's indigenous Arab population has been one of the hallmarks of Israeli society since the state was founded. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.